I've been talking for the last several weeks about this core quality or principle within Buddhist practice that gets translated as mindfulness. The original word is sati in Pali or smriti in Sanskrit. It means memory. And we've talked about it in various different ways over the last few weeks. And I'm going to continue, in a sense, to keep trying to trace some of the aspects or outlines of this practice, which is so completely central to the liberation project within Buddhism. And I would say it's central to the liberation project within both the Buddhist and Hindu yogas, but in very different ways. One of the ways that I've been enjoying talking about mindfulness is using the phrase somatic presence. And I say somatic presence because these are two aspects that feel really both vital, but in very different ways to the skill or the training, the mind state or mindset that we call mindfulness. I use the word somatic from soma, body. Soma is an important word in Sanskrit also, meaning something else entirely. Meaning like a sacred fluid, maybe the nectar of immortality, maybe an ancient psychotropic drug, maybe the moon, or the way that the moon is a sublimated mystical fluid in the body. Soma is all of that within the yogic systems. But the word somatic comes from the Greek soma, meaning body. It was coined by Thomas Hanna in the 20th century as a way of talking about modalities of work that have sensing your own body as the centerpiece of the work. So sensing the body means being in contact with, and this really means attentional contact with, the physical senses. So feeling sensations, tasting tastes, smelling smells, seeing sights, hearing sounds. And the physical senses, we can say, is one way, it's one map, one way to analyze bodily experience. And it's a way of saying that these are the five physiological channels or types of information that come in to the body through these various, we could call them, we'll say, sense organs. The Sanskrit word is ayatana. The ayatanas, the sense faculties. And so somatic presence, as a description of mindfulness, really highlights the way that mindfulness, in all of its descriptions in the early Buddhist framework, which is the primary framework I'm coming from, the Pali tradition, is discussed initially in terms of bringing attention or bringing a kind of focused awareness to the experiences of the body. And there's a list of bodily experiences to attend to that are the heart of mindfulness practice. And that list includes, you know, the posture of the body, so how the body is arranged in space. It includes where the body is, so like where you're practicing. This is how we began the meditation tonight. Know where you are in space, and then know the posture of the body. And then the breath, so recognizing the movement of breath, the breath in and out, the breath in the whole body, the breath as a experience through the whole body that we could then cultivate and relax into. The mindfulness teachings go on in the direction of body as foundation, saying that one should be mindful of or should hold in conscious awareness the movements of the body, going somewhere, coming back, bending and flexing the limbs, arranging one's clothing, carrying objects. And then a series of subtler analyses, so the experience of the senses and the experience of the body as elements, the qualities of hardness and softness, which is the earth element, of liquidity, of temperature, which is the fire element, hot and cold, movement, which is the wind element, and position in space, which is the space element. All of these, again, are a template for how to analyze or understand in some subtlety the experience of the body in a moment. And in a way, these are a bunch of different lenses, right? We could take any one of them. We could say, take the lens of posture and now become aware of your body in detail, right? Tune into your posture in some detail. Notice exactly the places where there's muscular holding to maintain a posture, where it's relaxed. Notice the angles of the limbs, the bend in the joints, all of the aspects of posture. And if postural practice in yoga is one of your main forms of practice, you have a lot of training in this, right? As we attend to alignment and the position of the body, it's partly a training in, like, where is my body in space? Right? The Western term for this would be proprioception. Proprioception is a term for the kind of awareness that knows the position of the body in space. And some of the great kind of tests or experiments or cultivations of proprioception are things like close your eyes and you know, put your limbs out in a direction and notice that even with your eyes closed, you know where your hands are, probably. You don't necessarily. And proprioception will be, in a sense, diagnostic for how present you are in the body. As in, if mental illness is deep, or trauma is deep, or in whatever way the symptom of dissociation, of disembodiment, of not being present in the body, is deep in you, and this is primarily a result of trauma, that skill weakens. And for folks who are profoundly wounded, that knowing how the limbs are arranged in space can weaken to the point of not being accessible. So this is a basic skill of wellness, right? And it's a basic skill for safety. As you move through the world, you want to, like, not step on a nail or not walk into the wall. You know those moments when you, like, you're walking through your house and you're just so gone, you're thinking about something, and you just, like, walk into the wall. Right? I'm like, I've walked through this doorway 100 times, and today I missed it by 1.5 feet. Like, right? What was happening? It's like, well, I wasn't present, is what was happening. Right? So presence is embodied in this very basic way. So in the mindfulness texts, mindfulness of the body in place, in posture, in movement, in action, in doing things, in the subtle experiences of the senses and the qualities that one senses, which are the elements, right? I feel the floor, that's the sensation part of the 5 senses, but I also contact hardness, and hardness is the earth element, or I contact the softness of the blanket, which is the earth element. So I could tune into the quality of touch and say, oh, this touch is happening, touch is like this. Or I could tune into the quality that I'm perceiving. It's like, oh, this is hard. Hardness is like this. Softness is like this. In both of those cases, I'm using one of those basic frameworks for analyzing experience. At the heart of probably the earliest layer of mindfulness of the body is a practice of observing or thinking about the stages of a corpse in decay, thinking about a freshly dead body and then a decomposing body and then a rotting body and then a drying up and breaking apart body. There's 9 stages that are described in some detail in the texts. And this is also part of mindfulness of the body. Right? And of course, the hinge that is so important in this is both to see that this is how it happens, and then to remember, as we do in the recollections each time, right? I am subject to dying. I have not gone beyond dying. To remind ourselves that this is the nature of the body, to change in this exact way, and that this is unavoidable. So mindfulness of the body isn't like a neutral, you know, remove, where you just, like, kind of, you know, observe your body going about its business, but don't get involved. It's a deeply involved presence. And that presence is somatic. So somatic presence, the presence part of it refers more to what the mind is doing. What the mind is doing in mindfulness, if what we're doing is attending to the body and its postures, its movements, its sensations, the things it's aware of, and in a different way, in the recollection of death. But you're supposed to do it actually seeing bodies. So there's a special permission in many of the Buddhist countries for monks and nuns to go and observe autopsies and dissections, because it's so central to liberation practice to see dead bodies in a wholesome and safe way, right? And of course, here we either don't see them at all, or we only see them in moments of horror. And that's exactly not the point here, right? The point really is actually to remember, in a moment when you could be like sober and gathered in your faculties and not threatened, to actually just calmly, with some focus and some, and a warmth in the heart, to see this and be like, oh, this is a body. This is what happens to bodies. If you go deep into the online Buddhist world, you'll eventually find your way perhaps to sites that have images of dead bodies. They're hard to find. It's not, you know, I don't want to scare you, newbies to Buddhism. But this is an ancient, venerable practice, and it's possible to find those images and practice with them. And in my training, there was a moment when we were handed out, you know, paper handouts with images, just to say, like, this is an ancient core practice. This is being mindful of the body right now. So that one's a little more future, right? Because you're not dead yet. It's nice to have you here. Not dead yet. But all of the others, you're meant to observe them as they happen. And so what is presence then? This thing that presence points to, we think of as like the present moment. As in, I'm not thinking about the past, I'm not thinking about the future. The reminder in the texts goes something like, the past is gone and can be neither preserved nor fixed, which is both, you know, cuts both ways, of course. The future is not yet here and cannot be guaranteed. Therefore, let your attention rest in the present. And this has become, in a way, almost the most central thing emphasized in modern mindfulness, especially in the West, is that something kind of amazing happens when we bring our attention out of the realms of past and future and into the experience of what's happening right now. And this is completely tied into it being a somatic experience. What's happening right now is physical. There's nothing happening right now that isn't physical. To do this well, we have to, this is a bit of a footnote, to do this well, we really have to recover from, in a way, the deep, deep ideology or philosophy in all of the cultures descended from the European Enlightenment, that mind and body are separate in some way. This was Descartes' great error. It's an error in a certain way. It's not an error in other ways. He was trying to describe a very particular thing. He was trying to prove the existence of God, and claimed that he had done so logically. And the claim that because he notices that he thinks, therefore he knows that he exists. Right? I think, therefore I am. And that became the idea that spirit and matter, or mind and body, were irrevocably separate. That thing that he came up with, that we would now say from a postmodern but also a yogically influenced position, is an error. We could say it's an error in the way that we want it to be a statement about reality. But what it was for him actually was just a step in his logical argument moving toward the existence of God. And so, taken within that argument, this is really a footnote on Descartes, taken within the context of that argument, it's actually not wrong. It follows from his sequence. But it's not useful most of the time for us, because its effect in so many of the Western cultures has been to support forms, particularly of patriarchy, that marginalize or deny the very real experience of bodies. And so to come into the direct experience of bodies is to come into something that pushes against power structures that seek to, that control bodies in so many ways. So, I can't say that without noting that this is the morning where a new Supreme Court justice was proposed, who is extremely hostile to some of the rights of bodies. So, just to put that on the record. So, somatic presence as a definition for mindfulness. We come into the body as a direct experience, and we come into this moment in time as a direct experience. What does coming into mean? Because it's not like when I'm distracted, I'm actually somewhere else. Right? I'm walking across the living room, I'm totally distracted, I'm about to walk into the wall. But it's just a metaphor to say I was not present. What does that mean? What was happening is that my attention, the mental quality of consciousness or attention, was not engaged with sensory material. It was engaged with thought material. It was engaged with memory or projection. Right? So it was engaged with the future or the past in positive or negative feeling tone, basically. Positive future, hope, positive, or future positive hope, future negative fear. Past positive nostalgia, past negative, you know, regret, wounding, trauma, remorse. So, coming out of those realms that are the substance of the story of ourself, the story, my narrative, here's where I was, here's where I'm going, dropping that really means dropping, giving my attention to that narrative for a while. And when I do that, attention comes to the body. Where else could it go? Right? It comes to what's happening here and now. That's always going to be sensory information. So if that's a definition for mindfulness, attention comes into the here and now in place and in time, space and time. It comes into the body and into contact with the senses, with sensory or somatic experience. Then what? Why is that useful? Why is that the center of the liberation project? The proposal goes something like this. Suffering, the word is dukkha, in Pali and Sanskrit, suffering or stress or pain, dissatisfaction are all translations of this word, is the result essentially of thought. It's the result essentially of having a sensory experience, and sensory here means sensory or emotional, of course, because emotions are sensations. Having an experience and being in wrong relationship with it. I'm hesitant to completely lean on the word wrong. Wrong here means misperception, essentially. You know, in the way that you know, when I see a shimmering down at the end of a desert highway, and I think, oh, there's a lake over there. That's fine. It's not true, right? It's a mirage. But I'm particularly going to suffer if what I am is really thirsty or I want to take a dip or something. And so I start to hook onto the idea that there's a lake there. It's fine to make the perceptual mistake, right? But if I'm not bent out of shape about it, I'm not suffering. But if I make the perceptual mistake and then I grasp at the thing I'm perceiving wrongly, I make a mistake and then I get hooked on it, then really painful. Right, and then the proposal here is that the vast majority of our relationship with the world and each other is based in misperception. In other words, we're not seeing each other clearly, and we're not seeing our situation as living beings clearly. And some of those core misperceptions are like right now I'm young and beautiful and strong, and it doesn't really occur to me that all those things are temporary. Or right now I'm safe, you know, and it doesn't occur to me that that's temporary. Or right now I'm under threat, and I don't realize that that's temporary either, right? One of the main perceptual mistakes we make is to project permanence on things that aren't. Right? I think that a feeling that I'm having is going to last, even though it never does. And if we take this all the way, and Gautama was the king of taking it all the way, to its final implications, it says things like, oh, this way that I perceive myself in the world, like who I am, what I'm doing, who we are, what we're doing, all of that is accurate on one level and not accurate on many other levels. And the ways that it's inaccurate are what causes us suffering. The ways that something's happening and I'm resisting it or unclear about my relationship to it. And so then the proposal, if this is true, that so much of what causes us pain is really a kind of reactivity based in a fundamental error. And for those tracking the technical words, the fundamental error, avidya, ignorance, not seeing clearly, and the primary error is attachment or grasping, getting fixated, solidifying something that can't be solidified. If that's what we're doing much of the time, and it's causing so much pain and distress, the way to stop doing that is to see things more clearly. It's to actually see what's happening. It's like, oh, I'm seeing you right now. This moment of seeing you is fresh. It's immediate. It's colored by the past, but it's not determined by the past. And it won't sustain. Any one of us could die later this evening. Any one of us could just be taken by the streams of karma and our narrative elsewhere. And that's always true. If that's the case, then a deep letting go or opening to the much more dynamic but less fixed, less reliable flux of ongoing experience is not only a thing we should do if we want to get liberated, it's actually the only thing we can do once we start to see clearly. So mindfulness says, see clearly, right? Notice your body moving through space. Notice what your actions. Start to notice, you know. We practice this in really ordinary, prosaic ways. So we practice it like in relation to mindfulness of the body. I'm sitting on this little corner of blanket. It's the way I sit with yoga blankets because it keeps my legs from falling asleep, so that's a good thing. But the only way that it really works is if it's quite firm, and that means that my sit bone gets a little pressure at this point in the evening. That's a little unpleasant. Right? So I have this slightly unpleasant sensation. There's an accurate way to perceive that somatically, which is basically like, if I use the categories of mindfulness, it would be something like, I'm perceiving my body and its posture. I'm perceiving an area of sensation. That sensation is unpleasant, and it's characterized by the sensation of contact, and it's contact with hardness. The blanket's kind of firm. There's pressure, right? So there's the awareness of the earth element. There's the awareness of the quality of unpleasantness. One of the main things we are to track in mindfulness is when things are pleasant, unpleasant, or neutral. Because that's the main thing that we react to in this world of misperception, this pattern of misperception. So basic mindfulness says that's what's happening. I'm having a sensation, it's a little unpleasant, I know why, I know what I'm contacting. That's it. Right. According to the mindfulness, to mindfulness as a system of inquiry, that's accurate, and that's enough. That's all I need to know about it. Right? I could concentrate it, or I could ignore it. That's just a choice, depending on what I'm trying to cultivate. But I know what it is. I'm not deluded about it. But without mindfulness, I'm likely going to do something else with it. And something else is usually a story. And the story might go something like this. Oh no, my sitting posture hurts again. It doesn't seem like it hurts for people who are awesome meditators, so I kind of probably suck as a meditator if my sitting posture hurts. My sitting posture has kind of hurt a little bit, kind of a lot, for the last 25 years. That's probably why I haven't gotten very far in meditation, because it just starts to hurt eventually, and then I don't have very good will, so I move, even though I think I probably shouldn't, so I suck. Right? So what am I doing, right? I'm basically projecting psychology, really. Like, I'm projecting a narrative about myself onto what is otherwise, you know, a sensation. Only a sensation. Like, that's what it is. So when I start to practice mindfulness, one of the first things I notice is not that I, like, suddenly drop into sensation and everything is just, you know, a kind of ever-unfolding, you know, river of sensate experience, and I rest into the ongoing flux of the universe. Like, that's the culmination of practice in a certain way, or that's a step in the culmination of practice. The first thing that usually happens is I come into contact with it, I notice all the things I'm reactive of, and I spend a lot of time distracted. Right? The mind wanders all the time, over and over and over. And I can really swirl in those kinds of stories. And this is really like projection and appropriation is what I'm doing. I'm scooping up a sensory experience, and I'm making a whole narrative out of it. That's the way that it's individual. But of course, so many of those narratives are not individual. So there's that layer. But it gets worse. Sorry. And the worst layer is that those narratives, those stories, mostly have been taught to us by culture, by family, by communities, by the way that our culture understands or wants us to understand experience. And so there are cultural stories that'll come in. You know, one of those might be, one of those that tormented me for a while was, you know, oh dear, sitting is uncomfortable. Maybe I should get one of those nice buckwheat cushions. But damn it, they're $50 at Whole Foods. That's a lot of money for a cushion. And so, like, oh, okay. So, you know, so that's one thing. Like, oh, you're unsatisfied. There's stuff you can buy. Yeah, that's a projection. That's a projection of capitalism into your psyche. And again, it's scooping up or appropriating a basic sensation in embodied life, which is pain, dissatisfaction. You know, oh, I'm unsatisfied. Maybe we should, you know, maybe we should go get some Thai food. It's mango season, right? Basically, like, the experience of being a little hungry or a little tired is not perceived directly with mindfulness. I'm not present with it. It immediately turns into, how can I entertain this feeling away? And it's entertainment simply because, you know, I could have just gone home and had, you know, had some very ordinary food that I have at home, but some part of me is like, mango and sticky rice, that would really solve both my hunger and my subtle existential dissatisfaction in this moment. Plus my urge to connect, you know, with something, you know, Asian, which I think of as spiritual. So all of these things come in, and at the cultural level, this is going to be things like, you know, Orientalism, racism, sexism, etc. These are the deep stories of dissatisfaction that ask us to, you know, behave in a certain way. And again, mindfulness subverts them if we can get good at it, right? So, you know, there are some of the deep stories are things like, you know, oh, I'm walking along the street, I see someone who is of a different color than me, and I'm either attracted or confused or afraid. I have a response to, let's say, race, to racial sameness or difference. That is taught to us. And it's built in so deeply in our culture right now. But what that means is that mindfulness has to wake up to that layer of the narrative. Otherwise, I'm just grasping onto something. I'm grasping onto color, right? I've been taught to be afraid of those who are what was the line from what's the song? She's like, we're highly melanated. Who is that? Who was that?
Janelle Monáe.
Thank you, Janelle. Fans in the room. We're highly melanated. I'm like, oh my God, highly melanated. Right. So I've been taught to be afraid of people that are highly melanated. Right? What's up with that? What that means, really, is that there's all these moments where, you know, my stream of somatic presence is hijacked by a story that takes this basic sensation, like seeing another human being whose skin has whatever color it has, and rather than just it being a seeing, oh, I'm seeing this person, I could notice anything about them, but I've been trained to notice this in a subconscious and profoundly influential way, you know, and likewise, you know, likewise gender, likewise class, likewise physical ability, many other aspects of difference. So one of the things that becomes socially and politically radical about mindfulness is that as we start to attend to somatic information in the present moment, what we'll see is all of the layers and layers of messaging and narrative and deep non-presence that have been trained into us from these huge cultural things that perpetuate racism, sexism, etc., all the way down to the sense of my being who I am, right? The way that you know, my parents, you know, God bless them, over and over, in a way that's developmentally appropriate, they said, you're Sean, you know? But they said all sorts of other things too, right? They were like, you're Sean, you're a boy, you can do anything you want. Will support you no matter what you choose to do, right? That's indoctrination. And that was a good thing, right? They were kids of the 70s. They did the best they could. They did decently, as far as I can tell. I have some complaints. But what were they doing in doing that? And, of course, I'm doing the exact same thing with my son, right? I'm like, this is your name. This is, you know, it's like, oh, you did that. He does something. He's like, I built a tower. And I'm like, look at that tower you built. What are we doing as we build up the ego, build up the self, is we build basically a scaffolding of stories that help explain somatic experience, somatic life, right? We've built a whole story around what it means to get an injury or what it means to be happy or what it means to be hungry or fed or emotionally connected. We've built in the story, apparently, that you kiss injuries. Right? He falls down, he skins his knee, do you want a kiss? Yes, you get a kiss, he kisses it, it's all better. Now, when he bumps into something or falls down, he just kisses his hand and smacks the injury spot. He goes, and then he goes on. He's like, I can do this myself, and I can do it quickly. Whack. Done. It's great. It's a subtle misperception. You know, but it works. All of the misperceptions work in a certain way to structure our experience. Some are more wholesome, some are less wholesome. But mindfulness sees them. As mindfulness takes root, you see them more and more. And so the individual culmination of mindfulness practice is that you learn over time to set aside the convenient misperceptions called my ego structure and, you know, my framework of the world around me. And you learn to see or stay with, to connect and sustain attention with, moment-to-moment somatic experience. What seems to happen when you can do this for, you know, 10 to 20 minutes at a stretch without a single intervening distraction, that's about the length where shit starts to get weird. That's a technical translation. Of something like, you know, enters the stages of vipassana. But what seems to happen is that with enough of a break from the perceptual overlay of narrative, perception actually can lock into moment-to-moment sensory experience in a way that starts to take much less effort and starts to reveal aspects of ongoing experience to us that aren't available when we're more distracted. And one of those things becomes this perception that everything is pouring forward through the body as this flood of sensory information. Right? What if, you know that basically what's happening, I don't know if you know, but one of the models for what's happening, let's say, in visual perception is that this, like, wild, like, welter of light and color and movement and shape and is pouring in. And what the brain kind of does is filters through all of it, looks for matching patterns. Like, I recognize these things and I don't recognize these things. And it basically tries to not work very hard. In other words, it puts everything into categories that it recognizes. It has to do this, right? So, like, without even thinking about it, my mind, goes around the room and, tags everything in the room with, like, its name, its function, its age, its gender, its activities, why it might exist, all of those things without, before I even think about it. And then if something is a little weird and I don't recognize it, the mind kind of fixates on it. Like, what is that thing? Right? It's like it's like a mirage. If I don't decide that it's a lake, I'm confused because there shouldn't be a shimmering on the road. And the brain does not like confusion. So it's going to come up with a narrative for things, even if it's wrong. So like, oh, here comes someone who's highly melanated. Must be dangerous. Right? I have no idea whether that's true. But it actually feels safer for the perceiving mind to have a story than to not have a story. And so then I'm susceptible to stories being implanted. Be afraid of these people, be attracted to these people. Once the stories are not gone, they're never gone, but framed with mindfulness, the flow of somatic experience becomes this kind of amazing thing. Because at a certain point, you stop even pinning things down into their recognizable categories. You can actually subvert this thing that goes around putting everything into its recognition box. It's relatively easy to do this with, a strong dose of LSD or psilocybin. It's relatively difficult to do it in meditation, but you can. It takes sustained practice for many people, like long retreat, long focused retreat. But I want to end by just suggesting a couple of the implications of this. Okay, so this is a thing you can do. Focus on moment-to-moment somatic experience. Drop the stories. Rest in immediate presence. So first of all, why would you want to do this? Right? One immediate answer is that most of our distress is in thought. Most of our distress is anxiety and depression and, regret and rumination. So if you stop doing those things by focusing on what's happening here and now, a lot of that stress drops. So one of the first things that happens for folks who get a little mindful is that they get a little happier. Right? The general stress level drops. This is basically why it's the, most popular self-help maneuver right now. But what are some other implications? If the implications are that you are dropping narrative in a certain way, it also means you're dropping believing in layers of your training, both your inner psychology, who you are, what your purpose is in life, what you're here to do, your identity in the way that you drop yourself into or agree to imposed, social identities. What's your gender? What's your sexual preference? What's your, what is that stuff, right? That stuff, in part, is aspects of narrative that either you come up with yourself or are projected onto you. What happens if you drop those things? If there's no thought about who I am, who am I? Let that one rest as a, deep thoughts with you know. But it is the question that all this hinges on. But I want to propose also that this quality that you could drop narrative and rest in immediate somatic experience is a bit of a secret radical act. When folks start becoming deeply present to themselves, to their stories, to those around them, a few things tend to happen. They tend to become kinder, which is great, right? We like that. But they also may become, for instance, like less ambitious. You know, corporate America really loves mindfulness right now. I mean, mindfulness, you know, is being taught to sharpshooters, to snipers in the Marines. Because, of course, if you're concentrated and focused and not distracted, of course you can shoot people more accurately. So mindfulness in and of itself is neither wholesome nor unwholesome. It's just a quality of focused attention. But when people start focusing and actually perceiving the play of experience, getting less caught in projection and appropriation, story, layers of our human experience that maybe are more basic, like a very basic respect for life and for others, for the rights of others, the dignity of others, starts to emerge. A friend of mine was in the administrative staff at the Google Mindfulness project called Search Inside Yourself. And told me at one point, and she said, don't publicize this. So that was some years ago. So now I talk about it. I think the statute of limitations has passed on don't publicize this. But I won't say her name. She said they were quietly tracking attrition, that people would do the Search Inside Yourself program, Google employees would do the program, and then quit their jobs. And like, you know, go off and do like a yoga training or sail around the world or hang out with their kids more or, you know. What if mindfulness, bringing attention into the body in a sustained and intimate way, has the power to disrupt the hold that the great ideologies have on us, the hold that capitalism and consumerism and militarism and patriarchy and sexism and racism have on our psyches? What if that's almost one of the most important things it could do now? And that is a prerequisite to the personal liberation aspect. That, like, you can't actually get individually liberated until you unbind those aspects of communal narrative from your system. You can't just unbind the personal narrative. Oh, I'm just emptiness unfolding. It doesn't work. Because the personal aspect of your narrative is inseparable from the communal aspect of who you are. It may be that most of who you are is not personal to you, but is a quality owned by the collective. Right, most of your thoughts, you didn't make them up. They're not original to you. Right, you were taught to think in certain ways, in certain patterns, with certain words. Mindfulness undoes all of that. And so it's both the pathway to liberation, it's possibly a radical action in relation to the deep ideologies. And unfortunately, although it tends to start off reducing stress, once you start actually seeing clearly enough to unbind your narratives, that tends to be painful. So the work then is to become so present in ourselves that we let go of resisting the process of seeing clearly layer after layer after layer of who we think we are, including who we are in the collective or in our culture. And as we see layers and see the mistake or the limitation in thinking that supports that level of meaning, if we can see that clearly enough, it's said that level of meaning simply becomes a non-issue. The ancient metaphor is if you're walking along a forest path and you see a coiled rope in the half light, you might think it's a snake and be afraid of it. But when you see it not moving and you get closer and you realize that it's a rope, the fear drains away because it's clear that it's not the threat that it looked like. And once you see that that rope is not a snake, you'll never again think that it's a snake and believe it. Right? You'll see it, you'll know that it's a rope. So, mindfulness unbinds all of the constrictions of narrative from our hearts. And it changes radically how we exist in the world. So, any questions or reflections on in this realm, last few minutes? Reflections on mindfulness itself, reflections on your practice of it.
Grounded me in a way that's tempered my ambition.
Mm-hmm.
But I also think that that there's still a lot of drive in there, and there is it's really empowering to have both the ambition and the consciousness.
Mm-hmm.
Like that's a really it's a really heady type of feeling, and I think that you can do a lot with that. You can do a lot more with that.
Yeah.
Socially, I think.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah.
TBD, but.
For sure, for sure. I'm happy to hear it from you, and it's true for me too. You know, traditionally the community of practitioners was divided into those who stay in the home life and have families and engage in business of various kinds, move energy around, transform resources, and those who step away from the family life and the creation of resource to rest fully into this stream of unfolding experience. So this is a distinction between lay people and monastics. And there aren't so many monastics around anymore. There's some. You can go find them. But not so many. So then as lay people who are interested in liberation of any kind, we are in this interesting position where it's clear that some amount of becoming more conscious reduces stress. It's also clear that a lot of wise action is needed in the world right now.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and there's a lot that needs to be done from a place of mindful presence. You know, what can we do from that place, and how would we do it differently? You know, from this position of presence than if we were doing it from any of the great mistakes of perception.
Mm-hmm.
You know, one of the great mistakes, for instance, is that it's a battle, and that we have to win the battle.
Mm-hmm.
And once we win the battle, everything is going to be okay. Right? That's wrong. But it's so seductive. It's only wrong because it just doesn't work that way. There's no winning. You know, there's winning temporary little moments. You know, hashtag win the morning. But
what is winning?
What does it mean? What does it mean? It means you got what you wanted temporarily. You know.
But you just go down the rabbit hole.
It's like, okay, you know.
There was one other thing I wanted to say.
Yeah.
That they were separated. you know, living the cloistered life or having an ambitious business life. But why were, I mean, it, was it ever necessary to separate them? And, like, now we're in this age where we can have them so closely mm-hmm. together that we don't need to separate them. And that, that to me, is the, so much, there's so much potential in that.
Yeah. Yeah. Different, different lineages had different views on the necessity of that separation. You know, at the extreme end of separation are, you know, traditions where monastics would go into deep retreat for decades in solitude to practice. At the extreme end of non-separation, you know, might be a tradition like Judaism that doesn't have a monastic wing, where the fullness of spiritual life is family life and working in community. In a way, you know, the all three of the Western monotheisms do make a really different gesture in relation to the separation than either, you know, Buddhism or Hinduism and the yogas did. From the perspective of the yogic traditions, one of the reasons for separation in a certain way is really practical, which is that this the intensity of clear seeing and clarification of the mind that is needed for deep liberation takes a lot of time. And it takes a lot of time and protected space for most people.
Mm-hmm.
And so if we want to make a condition where a number of people can get radically liberated, not just a little bit, but all the way, whatever that means,
mm-hmm.
we have to have spaces where some people at least can essentially meditate 24/7. And so to do that, we would then, if we as a community value that, we would want to support a few folks to do that.
Mm-hmm.
So that's one justification for the monastic order, is that it makes a structure where some folks can give, you know, every bit of their life's energy to this thing. And it's clear that deep meditation, in the way that's described in all the classical traditions, is simply not available for most folks in ordinary life, just statistically. A few people are very talented and can land in those states, but most can't. I certainly can't. And so then I had to do a kind of separation. I went on long retreats, basically, months of retreat at a time,
mm-hmm.
because I wanted to come closer to the
mm-hmm.
this inquiry that the texts were describing, and I just can't do it in ordinary life. So that's a reason for the separation, but there is this new thing happening right now where there's folks who, and many folks in the room here are like this, who are lay people, not monastics at the moment, but very dedicated to serious practice. And so folks who go on, you know, meditation retreats, longer retreats, who might spend time as a monastic or give, you know, a really substantial portion of their time and energy
mm-hmm.
to the contemplative practice. When I was at my peak of retreat practice, I was really trying to be on retreat for 3 months a year. That was what I could figure out how to do. And that, for me, was just enough to get me into sort of the doorway of these
mm-hmm.
this kind of inquiry.
Mm-hmm.
And I think of myself as a little bit slow as a meditator. I had friends who didn't take them quite as long to get in the doorway. But there is this thing now, it's really a 20th century invention of folks, not completely, but in its current model, it's newish, of folks who stay lay people, who stay engaged in business and family and sexuality and money and property and politics, but who give a good chunk of their energy to mindfulness and meditation, concentration, yoga, and really hold an ideal of liberation,
mm-hmm.
you know, in the midst of it all. And so, you know, please.
I just bring it down.
What's that?
I don't want to cut you off. But
please do.
Okay.
It's time to cut me off.
Okay, I have a question, but I also actually want to say something real quick before I ask that question.
Please.
Is that something that I mean, something that I feel is true about what you're suggesting, that, you know, it's not necessary. in the context of life and the way that we are all contributing to being a large organism in some form, organisms can't exist without something that's such a variation of difference. And so as a human species, I really don't think that, I mean, this is kind of, you know, not very concrete logic to like suggest something about what you're saying, but I just don't think that it will ever be the case that there will be one kind of monochromatic sort of form towards any sort of path, and that as long as there's, you know, going to be people who are doing something dramatically one way, there's going to be people who are doing something dramatically another way, you know, just as human species, because that's the way that organisms function, is that they need that huge diversity of, they just need that huge diversity. So that's just something that I was thinking about. Mm-hmm. I don't know if that means anything to you, but but my question, Sean, is I would love if you would speak to, like in the context of what you were talking about, individual liberation versus socially communal liberation. speak something to the reconstructing of, or the constructing, not reconstructing, but constructing of new identity within the context of, you know, dominantly conditioned identity. And as far as you see it relating to dismantling our conditioning, you know, because, and I'm coming, that question for me is coming from really sort of piecing out the identities that I have defined within myself or adopted within myself that have allowed me to sort of disrupt some more prominent earlier conditioning, and then finding when they're still a value and when they're kind of holding me back and when I'm getting stuck in them, et cetera. So if you just will say something and how that fits into your
Totally. Totally. I think it's really important how actually constructing a new or alternative or, you know, more useful for now identity both helps disrupt a more toxic one that was offered to us earlier, but then itself, you know, evolves. The metaphor in the early texts, one metaphor in the early texts, the Buddha says, is just as a carpenter removes a coarse peg by means of a finer one, so does a practitioner substitute a finer state, or we could say identity, for a coarser one. And so when I think about identity in this way, in terms of like the big projections of culture, I think about communal identities, you know, like straightness and queerness and race and et cetera, gender. And so, you know, if the model in the Buddhist system is that when you become a monastic, you lose your caste, for instance, and your family designation, and you join the family of monastics, that becomes your identity. You become a bhikkhu or bhikkhuni, one who has left home, which also means like one who has left the identity of home. You've left your family name, you've left your communal identity, identification, your national identification, your caste. If that's the model, then the model is something like, we need to have communally recognized structures that are identities that are more wholesome than the toxic ones we inherited, so that we can move from a toxic cultural framework into a less toxic one, a more wholesome one, and then through that into one that eventually lets go of them entirely. You know, so the pathway seems in part, for instance, to be there's probably several kind of transition moments, if I reflect on it, that I can think about. One might be, you know, here's what I was told that I am. Here's what I actually feel like I am. Here's what other people around me can recognize me as and call me, you know, in the way that I want to be called, for instance. And so there's a process of self-determination. You know, I'm joining this community. I'm queer, or I'm whatever it is. And that, you know, in an interesting way, what if, you know, what if coming out, let's say, let's use coming out as the example, right? Everyone told me that I was supposed to be attracted to certain kinds of people, but it turns out I'm attracted to other kinds of people. But to make that shift public, I have to make a statement. I have to look the part or say something or do something to make it visible. What if coming out is a parallel to getting ordained, like to leaving home? You left your home life. You left your home sexual identity or whatever it was. And you came out into a thing that feels more wholesome, more true to yourself, safer. It's a kind of refuge in community. I'm going to be with these people. It'll be safer and I'll get more of what I seek. What if those processes are kind of parallel? You move from an unwholesome framework into a more wholesome one. And then that keeps refining over time. And it's very interesting that at a certain point in the text, the Buddha says, there are these... This is not where I can go, and we're already over time. So I'm going to go there, but in brief. Maybe I'll talk about it more later. The Buddha says, when you're getting liberated, there's four stages of liberation. And basically four different depths of seeing clearly. So at one point, it's interesting, the Buddha says there's four kinds of people in the world. There's people training for the first path, and there's people who have attained the first path. There's people training for the second, and who have attained the second, etc., for all four. There's basically people who have achieved a certain kind of profound identity shift in these four different ways, and then there's folks working on that, or not yet attained that. And that's all there is. That's a basic identity category, you know. So what if the model that suggests is something like, you know, there's folks who are mostly under the dominant conditioning, and then there's folks who have achieved the first moment of shifting out of that and claiming it for themselves, doing something, seeing clearly something about reality that changes who they are. And then there's folks who are working on a deeper step of that and who have attained a deeper step of that. And at each one of those, something changes about how I hold myself, but also, because identity is communal, how others hold me or how I figure out how to be treated by others. So yeah, basically, I think we, when it's going well, and when we have the freedom to do so, we substitute a more wholesome identity for a less wholesome one. And we keep doing that as we go along. As we see through the aspects of the thing that I created myself to be that are, you know, inaccurate, and the things that are more accurate. And then we lean toward the accurate. And then that further clarifies, and it further clarifies. Just a little bit in that direction. Maybe the last thing I'll say about that is the process of doing that all really depends on power. Because identity is primarily held in place by structures of power. And so to challenge who you think you are is always going to be a radical act of resistance to power. Because power in a certain way depends on us staying fixated and bound in very narrow categories of identity. Right? And of course, dissatisfied, because you don't buy stuff if you're not dissatisfied. Wake up. Waking up is like that. We'll stop here for tonight. We'll keep going over the next few weeks, looking at aspects of mindfulness. I'm calling this whole series at the moment, as a sort of elbow in Freud's ribs, I'm calling this little series of talks Mindfulness and Its Discontents. And they're all recorded on my website. You can go back if you've missed some and listen. It's been fun to sort of take it apart in a few different ways. We'll keep going in this direction. So come to Organic Intelligence Intros. Come on Tuesdays. We'll be here through the summer. I have no plans to be away anytime soon. And thank you for your presence and just your warm attention in your bodies in the circle tonight. It's really a pleasure to be with everybody. So take good care. See you soon.